Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. Be future ready with a pension powered by Zurich's award-winning investment performance.
Before Christmas, the world was shocked by the news that a scientist in China had produced the world's first genetically modified human babies. His colleagues the world over united in their condemnation, but there was some doubt if his claims could be believed. Earlier this week, the Chinese authorities confirmed, following an investigation, that the gene-edited babies had indeed been born. Designer babies, an enormous leap forward for the human race, but is it for good or for ill? Philip Boucher-Hayes has this report.
Imagine if we could cure heart disease in a patient before they were even born. Imagine if we could inoculate humans against all of the world's deadliest viruses, that humankind was on the cusp of entering an era of living disease-free. But if that technology existed, you'd have to imagine it could also be used to make all babies blonde and blue-eyed, that the wealthiest could design their own offspring, or it could all go wrong and we could create horrific new genetic defects. New gene editing technology means that none of this is science fiction any longer. In recent months, scientists have started producing humans, version 2.0. Are we at the cutting edge of a brave new world, or an unregulated Wild West?
A Chinese researcher has shocked the world by claiming to have created the first genetically modified humans.
I understand my work will be controversial.
I personally don't think that it was medically necessary.
I really admonished him not to do this kind of stuff.
And at that point, I really became quite angry.
120 Chinese scientists have penned an open letter calling the experiment crazy.
You can't get too far into his justification for this before it all starts to get weird.
Surgery for the cell, a way to slice out undesirable DNA using a revolutionary new gene editing technique called CRISPR.
A way for scientists to delete or insert specific bits of DNA that would offer opportunities to do things that really haven't been possible.
CRISPR had made deaf mice hear, created mushrooms that didn't turn brown, and it had worked in human cells in the lab. But nobody had edited the genes of a yet-to-be-born human being and then brought them into the world until the end of last year.
Two beautiful little Chinese girls named Lulu and Lala came crying into the world as healthy as any other babies a few weeks ago.
In November, a scientist in China, He Jiankui, reported that he had created the world's first human babies with edited genes, a pair of twin girls resistant to HIV. But he had allowed no peer review of his work. He had published on YouTube and not in a science journal. And there was no apparent medical necessity for the procedure. His critics charged that he had done it mainly because he could do it.
For this specific case, I feel proud, actually.
His colleagues didn't share pride in his work.
British scientists have condemned it as a monstrous experiment. I quote, highly irresponsible, unethical, and dangerous science akin to Russian roulette.
Everything that's emerged over the last week only adds to the concern about this having been a deeply unfortunate, misguided misadventure.
Some maintained that he had botched the procedure and edited out too much of the gene, exposing the girls to unknown consequences in their later lives. Others that he had only succeeded with one of the girls, making one sister uncomfortably superior to the other. There were even doubts that the girls existed at all, as he was offering no clinical evidence of their birth.
I hope these two little girls are okay. At this present time, it's hard to know.
This week, though, Chinese authorities announced the result of their investigation into He Jiankui. It confirms what many had doubted. Lulu and Nana do actually exist, and their genes have been modified. Humanity has taken a profound step. We can now design new and improved versions of ourselves. Human 2.0. The battle lines in a furious new ethical debate have been drawn. On the one hand, there are those who argue that just because we can play God, should we? versus those who argue, if we know how to reduce human suffering, how can we not?
At the moment, we're talking about changes to the human gene with the perspective of alleviating disease. Does that lead to another conversation that, well, if you can alleviate disease with this very smart technology, are we going to have people then seeking to improve the human condition by looking at, in fact, enhancements which have nothing to do with disease?
Asim Sheikh, the former vice chair of the now abolished Irish Council for Bioethics. He's a barrister and an assistant professor in the Department of Medicine in UCD. He doesn't argue for or against gene editing, but he does spend a lot of time thinking about the debates that we need to have about it.
Are we going to have people changing the human condition? And that's
better,
where...
Better, clever, faster, longer living.
Browner, whiter, whatever it might be, whatever your pocket allows, are we leading to, and it's something that ethicists certainly, and I'm not an ethicist, but will always use these words with caution, but are we sort of going down this slippery slope to whatever extent it may be slippery? But is this something that we want to do? Is this the future that we want to have?
Of course, a disease-free future is one that we can agree on. But many of us will draw a line when it comes to playing God, paying for more intelligent or conventionally beautiful babies. This technology opens the door to both, and we will not have one without the other. So what, says Asim, we play God every day. This is part of being the most advanced species on the planet.
It's arguable that we, in many respects, play God in our everyday lives, that science and medicine have played God for a very long time by simply improvement in health through public health programs. Whether you're playing God with one person, one animal, an entire species, some would argue that, you know, and philosophers, and I'm not a philosopher nor a theologist, but they would argue that perhaps it's our domain to play God in many respects. It's not God that we're playing, we're simply doing what we're doing with technology that's available.
So what is the technology that has made all this possible?
CRISPR is this fascinating, powerful technology. It's got a very clunky name. It's called Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeat.
Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic.
Clustered Regularly Interspersed Short.
Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats. A big mouthful. You can see why we use the acronym CRISPR.
CRISPR has surprisingly earthy and humble origins, discovered 30 years ago in E. coli. It's a naturally occurring part of a cell's immune defense system.
Part of the CRISPR system is a protein called Cas9 that's able to seek out and cut viral DNA.
The Cas9 protein is kind of like a copper on the beat, patrolling around cells, looking at their DNA with a mugshot in its hands. The mugshot is of the DNA of viruses that have attacked the cell in the past. And when the enzyme on patrol finds a bit of offending DNA that matches the mugshot in its hand, it leaps on it and cuts it out. A kind of a cellular level police force dedicated to keeping unwanted genetic defects out. CRISPR. For 20 years, scientists stood around oohing and aahing at this remarkable discovery. But 7 years ago, a scientist called Jennifer Doudna thought, what if we gave the enzyme the mugshot of something that we want removed?
A way for scientists to delete or insert specific bits of DNA into cells with incredible precision that would offer opportunities to do things that really haven't been possible in the past.
Want to remove genetically inherited cancers? Theoretically, CRISPR could do that. Want to knock out the mutations that cause cystic fibrosis or Huntington's disease? CRISPR could possibly do that too. What was more, CRISPR technology could be used in just about every organism, everything from wheat to humans. The boundaries of what was possible were limited only by our imaginations. Drought and disease-resistant foods adapted to grow in hostile environments, more nutritious crops, an end to diseases like malaria with the creation of resistant mosquitoes. Biologists were losing their minds with the scale of the possibilities.
The CRISPR technology can be used for things like enhancement, designer humans, if you will.
Remember Gattaca, a 1997 movie starring Ethan Hawke, Uma Thurman and Jude Law. You're listening to the film score now. Set in a future where, to those who can afford it, all undesirable genetic traits are engineered out before birth, these human 2.0s need never go for a job interview. Their superior intelligence and perfect health can be established with a pinprick test.
Congratulations.
What about the interview?
That was it.
Everyone else, unable to afford access to this gene editing technology, or those who prefer to let nature take its course, slip down society's ladder to a second-tier existence. Asim Sheikh says that this, again, is nothing new.
Who has access to this? Are we going to live in a world, as you say, where only those who can afford this very expensive technology will have access to it? And we're in a situation of genetic determinism and a genetic have-all and have-nots. And that is a possibility, and we end up in a Gattaca type of situation where those who can afford this technology can afford to live better lives, and those who don't have access to the technology live worse lives. But I'd say to you that that's a situation we unfortunately already deal with in many respects in modern day medicine in terms of access to pharmaceuticals, and we've seen this situation in relation to very expensive pharmaceuticals. It's a discussion we're probably having on a monthly basis as to how the public health sector makes available certain drugs that might not otherwise be available to those who most need it.
It may feel science fictiony, but it's actually the same debate that we're already having about access to healthcare. But here's where it gets different. If we are going to start improving people, making them different from the rest of us, how do we get their consent?
It's questionable as to whether you can ever achieve the standard. You can never seek the consent of any future generation. So if your perspective is, well, we would have to get the consent of future generations, the response to that is, well, you can't get the consent of future generations. And the end result is that, therefore, you could never carry out this work at all.
So you make it safe instead. You make absolutely sure that there is no chance of doing any harm, and then you go ahead and do it without consent. Although CRISPR is increasingly accurate, it's far from 100% safe, though. He Jiankui manipulated the embryos of several other couples, but those edits failed or he got them wrong. This is why, long before He Jiankui popped up on YouTube making his announcement, Jennifer Doudna and those who co-invented CRISPR called for a moratorium on its use in human embryos.
And this puts in front of all of us a huge responsibility to consider carefully both the unintended consequences as well as the intended impacts of a scientific breakthrough.
The question then arises as to whether we should ever allow that future to exist. Should we now begin to discuss where do we draw the line, and should a hard line be drawn?
Doesn't He Jiankui, though, prove exactly this kind of technological determinism? If we can, somebody eventually will. It's just going to happen.
I think that's absolutely correct. We have said this in the past, with the dawn of any new biotechnology or technology, and inevitably it has happened. Cloning was threatened a few years ago by the Italian obstetricians and gynecologists. They said that it would happen. Nobody knows if it has. Nobody has laid claim to that. But again, the same thought process happened there. If somebody can do it somewhere, and if we continue to be utterly unregulated, then it is an inevitability that the cat will come out of the bag, and it seems to have done in this situation. So yes.
CRISPR on its own would have consequences only for the gene-edited human and their direct descendants. The rest of us, imperfect humans, would be largely untroubled. But when CRISPR is married to another emerging innovation called gene drive, it can have immediate and dramatic consequences for entire species.
Scientists who had been editing the genes of mosquitoes so that they wouldn't carry malaria any longer hit on a technology to make their new bugs outbreed the contagion-carrying old ones.
A gene drive is a genetic arrangement that biases inheritance so that instead of the standard situation where you have one copy of a chromosome that you've inherited from mom, one copy that you've inherited from dad, and you have a 50% chance of giving either to your progeny, instead of that, you give a higher percent of one to your progeny than the other, and that's called gene drive.
With Gene Drive, scientists Ethan Beer and Anthony James proved that within 10 mosquito generations, just 5 months, they could completely replace the original mosquito population with their genetically modified mozzies. They could, in effect, make an entire species extinct for the very best of reasons, but still. And if you can do it to mosquitoes, theoretically, you can do it in any life form.
The first question we have to ask ourselves is that, as a society, what is the end of this technology? Why are we doing it? But you really have to scratch the surface a little bit further to see, but what are the potential consequences of something like gene drive technology?
I'm going to conjure up a perhaps slightly facile hypothetical here, but run with me because it might be illustrative or useful. Most people in Ireland would agree that it is desirable that the native red squirrel's population increase and that the grey squirrel's population be kept in check. If you were to marry CRISPR technology and gene drive technology and make all male grey squirrels infertile from here on, you could in a couple of generations make that population extinct. That really is playing God, isn't it? Making entire species extinct.
The extent to which we intervene in a species clearly is open to question. Will there be a downside to that if we get rid of the grey squirrel? If there is, we can't not have that discussion.
How long before one of my grey squirrels from Ireland migrates to North America and renders the entire grey squirrel population where it is native extinct?
Anytime we've had an intervention in relation to a species, you know, this has been done, for example, with the Africanized bee, all sorts of disasters. You can conjure up all sorts of disasters when human beings intervene in existing species. It has sometimes led to a very negative consequence. But are we going to be able to slow down the progress of this technology anytime soon? I think the answer to that is no, we're not going to be able to do that.
Is the human race at the right stage of its development for this technology? You know, for every Dr. Christian Barnard and open heart surgery pioneer, there is a Joseph Mengele out there. And the scope, the potential for this technology is just so far outweighs most other things that have come along in the last 40 or 50 years. It really, truly is potentially game changing or ruining.
You're absolutely right. The negative potential of this technology is immense in its scope. And again, in the wrong hands with those who perhaps will pursue this technology from a perspective of vanity, fame, commercialization without check, I agree this could lead to negative consequences. And there is no doubt about that.
But the rewards are too great to be Luddites as well.
Well, and that's exactly the point, that if we neglect having the discussion about the positive benefits, well, then are we potentially depriving ourselves as a society from a global, a national, and international perspective from the potential advantages? If we just look at it from the medical perspective in terms of alleviating suffering and disease, well, the answer is yes, we potentially are. And also to keep in mind that every time we have had a new technology, we've had naysayers and the negative consequences. We had this with the first test tube baby. We had this when we discussed gene therapy in the early 1990s.
But the first test tube baby became IVF programs, without which 8 million of us wouldn't be here, I think.
Precisely. And gene editing may be the next hope in terms of the paradigm shift of the evolution in terms of human health. We will suffer the negative consequences if we don't have a very honest, open and engaging conversation that includes society. And who is society? It's everybody. Without doing that, then there are potential problems on the horizon. But can we honestly say that this technology is so dangerous that we should, in fact, put it back in the tin, put the lid on and forget about it? Well, I think even if we wanted to say that, we're not going to have the ability to do that. So I think the better option is to accept that this technology is here, because it is. It's going to evolve in a very, very rapid way over the next few years, and we are better off engaging in a very open, healthy and adult ethical and legal discussion about how we are going to incorporate this technology for us in the current and in the future, and hopefully to everybody's benefit.
He Zhangqi told the world about what he was up to,
Reports from China suggest that there are at least four other laboratories actively gene editing human embryos and then carrying them to term. There is no regulation in this country preventing or controlling gene editing, nor is there any planned, unlike most other developed countries. There is also no national debate. In 2009, the government abolished the Council on Bioethics, the only place from which legislation was likely to come. He Zhangqi has shown if it can happen, it will. There is next to nothing to stop it from happening here.